Okay, we go to number four then. Translation. Maitreya Muni was greatly attached to him, the Lord, and he was listening in a pleasing attitude with his shoulder lowered. Okay, so that describes what's happening with Maitreya Muni. Okay, and then next, with a smile and a particular glance upon me, having allowed me to rest, the Lord spoke as follows. Yeah. So, of course, this is, generally speaking, Vidura, in the first four chapters of the third canto, how he met Uddhava. Of course, the real motivation for these chapters is the question at the end of the second canto by the sages, and they ask Sudha Goswami, you're talking all about how Brahma had darshan of Mahavishnu and things like that. But we heard that Vidura and Maitreya, you also mentioned Vidura, and we heard that he talked to Maitreya, and we know that Maitreya was heard the instructions to Uddhava, which were very confidential. So can you please tell us about the conversation between Vidura and Maitreya? You know? And so these first basically four chapters are like kind of like how Vidura met Uddhava and how Uddhava sent him to meet Maitreya. So now of the Uddhava is describing the situation, the scene. He came and saw Krishna under the tree, and I guess he was resting there, calming himself down after feeling so much separation, different things. And as I understand, then Krishna started to talk to Uddhava, explaining things, and Maitreya came, and Krishna didn't talk with him, but he nodded in a friendly fashion, indicated, please sit down, please sit down. So then Maitreya sat down. You know? So this verse describes the actual.
Maharaj, everything went silent all of a sudden. I hope you can hear us. Hold on. Okay, I got to exit out of the PowerPoint momentarily. How do I do that? Hi, Krishna Maharaj, can you hear us? Maharaj, we can't hear you for some reason. Let's see, maybe to be on the safe side, I should unmute everybody right now, just in case.
Oh. Powerball.
Okay, Maharaj, can you hear us? Test, 1, 2, 3.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Narahari Prabhu. Let's see. Well, maybe what I should do is I should hang up on him, just so he knows what's going on. He may have hit his mute button or something. Let's see. Let's try that. See what happens.
Could you call him on the phone?
Yeah. I should copy his number just in case that doesn't work. 505-3219. I bet you he hit his mute button. He didn't notice it. Let's see. I grabbed my cell phone. Try calling him.
Remember the time he gave a whole class? And
yeah, I'm sure he remembers it too.
Yeah, he mentioned it a bunch of times.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't want that to happen again.
He gave a great class.
I'm gonna mute myself. I'm driving back from the airport.
Oh, no.
Might be some truck problems.
Hello, Ramananda, can you hear me?
There you go. I was just dialing your number. Did you know that you had gone off the air?
Yeah, I heard a beep, 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 and then disconnected, and I didn't do anything.
Oh, okay. So we had a slight intermission there.
Maybe because we're like 7,000 miles apart or something.
Well, let's go back into the lecture mode. All right, so now only you can be heard, and we'll go back to that other slide, the translation.
Number five, yeah. Number five is the purport. Okay, so I was talking about how I see Prabhupada using the term monistic, many times. And I kind of wondered what it is, my experience kind of is, other people also make their comments, is that in these terms like, efficient cause, material cause, it seems that Prabhupada is following his education, his Scottish Church's college, he's following Bhaktisiddhanta's and Bhaktivinoda Thakur's comprehension of Western philosophy. And so it's probably something which is, more classical in that sense, not like very modern in the terminology, So in general, as I'm reading it, the monistic philosophy is one, which preaches the idea that we're all one, basically. The source is one. There's no distinction, so on. So from one point of view, of course, science, modern science tends to be a monistic philosophy, is that everything comes from matter. Now, of course, it's a big question of what is matter. But the most popular theory, of course, very overwhelmingly, is molecular atomic theory. Now, that, of course, brings us to the point of whether or not everything is composed of atoms and molecules and subatomic particles. And because of that, we see flowers, we see flower vases, we see people, we have wars, we have lust, we have alcoholism. It's all coming from those. Now, of course, the big thing, well, what is matter ultimately? Some people say it can only be understood in terms of waves. It's one uniform substance, and a uniform substance then it produces waves. And when the waves combine together, sometimes they produce, nodes. Like two waves going up, they hit each other, they make a real high wave. Or one wave going down, one wave going up, they hit each other, they make a flat thing. So that's the wave theory. The other theory, of course, description is particle theory. That is, we have actual particles, and the particles are not just like waves of the whole thing. So, whatever. And Prabhupada talks about speculations, monistic speculations. And boy, these guys speculate unbelievably. You have to learn a speculative language, which takes something like 18 years at least or something before you got the speculative language of mathematics down and your specialization like that. And so then you can make these unbelievable speculations, complicated things, and come back to maybe to the, what's it called, the singularity. Yeah, the singularity. And the singularity is, again, it's pretty much like it exists, but that's about the only quality it has. So it's kind of like nirvishesha. There's no time, no space. There's infinite mass, which of course is almost something like zero mass or something. Whatever. There's different speculations. And so this is the one monistic view. Another monistic view is that, maybe there's a God or something like that, but he's also part of the whole spiritual reality. So anyway, this is kind of like, as I got into it, I was reading a little bit, and it's something that as devotees we just naturally don't really get into. But Maitreya Muni, he's saying he was tinged with this. He's a devotee, but he has tinged with this monistic point of viewpoint. And so that means kind of like in some ways he doesn't really believe that Krishna exists. So it is kind of like a rough attitude for someone to put up with. When you're trying to talk to the guy and explain things to him, he doesn't really believe you exist, So he didn't talk to Maitreya. And as our comprehension goes, when he saw Krishna's relationship with Uddhava, for the first time he realized the importance of having a personal relationship with Krishna. So it seems like he wasn't really opposed to it, but maybe he never had heard anything more. I would think that if any of us met Maitreya Muni, we would think he was one of the nicest people we ever met. Humble and generous, mature, friendly, clean, sacrificing, all good qualities, And so he was a very nice candidate. So anyway, he is describing here that Krishna's attention was more on Uddhava than Maitreya, even though Maitreya was a great soul because his viewpoint was mixed with a monistic attitude. Let's go to the next slide then, number 6. And Prabhupada continues, The Lord reciprocates with his devotees on the basis of transcendental love and not on the basis of philosophical knowledge or fruitive activities. Now we're going to two things are here. Now he's adding the karma bodies. And they approach Krishna because they want something. I mean, I approach Krishna because I want something. I want lunch. You know, I want justification for my entertainment. And I want a fun service. You know, so many things. You know, so my service is mixed with desires for fruits. You know, and then philosophical knowledge. My goodness, it's kind of maybe beyond this. But again, this is the kind of speculation where we try to, produce harmony and get rid of these problems like the Battle of Kurukshetra, I guess. In the transcendental loving service of the Lord, Prabhupada says, there is no place for monistic knowledge or fruitive activities. Yeah. The gopis in Vrindavan were neither highly learned scholars nor mystic yogis. They had spontaneous love for the Lord, and thus he became their heart and soul, and the gopis also became the heart and soul of the Lord.
Yeah. Maharaj,
yeah?
I think you missed a slide. I think
I
that...
five and then six. Yeah.
But, we're on six now, unless I'm just spaced out, which may be. Did you miss number five?
Well, number five is the one with the flower base on it.
Okay, all right, sorry. And then my apologies for the devotees that are watching this. The slideshow seems to have a mind of its own. That's why it slips between us. Okay, sorry for the interruption.
Okay, no, it's fine. It's actually nice to hear a human being every now and then. Remember the time I gave the entire presentation and nobody was listening? I remember that. Okay, so number six, the gopis were neither highly learned scholars nor mystic yogis. They had spontaneous love for the Lord, and thus he became their heart and soul, and the gopis also became the heart and soul of the Lord. So it's interesting that Prabhupada goes right from Maitreya Muni, who appears to have some, Mayavad or something, or Brahmavad, view of reality, and Uddhava, who's a Dwarkavasi, who's trying to be promoted to Vrindavan, to the highest level of the Vrijbasis, the gopis. You know, right away he goes to the attitude of the gopis. And of course, I guess because they're the example. You know, like we're trying to understand them intellectually here, but it's the whole point. If we met them, the point is we would think, wow, they're just very, simple girls, and they probably would ask you questions about philosophy and logic and stuff, and, please can you tell us this, can you explain that to us? Well, okay, But so what is this mysterious thing they have, And it says they have spontaneous love for the Lord. Okay. And it's amazing. It's a whole thing to go into this. And Rupa Goswami, of course, begins to explain it. And Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And then with Ujjvala Nilamani, he goes into more details and explains this different attitudes of pure conjugal love with no material contamination, with no connection to sense gratification through the body. And then we begin to see it's such a beautiful structure of different feelings that can be combined and changed and added and removed like that. And these conjugal feelings and the bodily features and forms of Krishna and the gopis are all then part of this, which surpasses any intellectual gratification of putting things together intellectually, like a game of chess. So much intellectual gratification at a rather low level in some ways. But still, it's so wonderful. And if you go beyond that, then the rasas and tastes of combining together the different aspects of conjugal love is so relishable. So Krishna enjoys that ultimately. Okay, slide number seven. Okay, Lord Chaitanya, Prabhupada finishes, approved the relationship of the gopis with the Lord as supreme. Herein, the Lord's attitude towards Uddhava was more intimate than with Maitreya Muni. So it seems that Prabhupada is pointing this out, that he's mentioning the relationship of the gopis because that's what Lord Chaitanya presented, that their attitude was the greatest. Then he goes back and look at the present situation, and he says, herein, the present situation, the Lord's attitude towards Uddhava was more intimate than with Maitreya Muni. So many, many different levels. And if we go to our next slide there, number 8. Okay, then here we have a picture of some ladders. Different people on different levels of the ladder. And then we put in karma, mishra, bhakti, jnana, mishra, bhakti, and jnana, mishra, bhakti. So, of course, in chapter 6 of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks about yoga ruksha and yoga ruda, the yoga ladder, starting off from the lowest level. And there, most of the connections are through activities and informal processes and rituals and, you know, doing things, karma, activities. And, of course, very much related to, to our natural tendencies and abilities, like a yoga given for, you know, someone in the desert. It'd be different than the yoga for someone who's in northern Germany. You know, for example, there was probably no Christmas tree. The Christmas trees and the manger when Jesus was born. And Jesus wasn't born under a Christmas tree, under a pine tree, like that, or maybe under a coconut tree. You know, but we don't see Jesus and the manger under a coconut tree. But there's different karma reactions, nature that people have. Somebody is a woman. Somebody is an old man. Somebody is a 17-year-old boy, right? Something like that, you know. So we have our karma, and therefore our connection, the beginning, has to be along those lines, you know. But our understanding is Brahmande Brahmate Kong, Bhagyavan Jeev, Guru Krishna Prasadi Paya, Bhakti Lata Bija. By the mercy of Guru and Krishna, we can get this transcendental experience, you know, some spark, you know. Like I tell this example of Bhaktapala Ignoza. You've heard it before. He was a cool dude in New York. Maybe like about 22 or something. And he was going around. He was investigating the whole theater scene. You know, and he was pretty clean person, but getting into all the things happening there with the different improvisational theaters and all this stuff going on. And of course, he read about the Hare Krishnas. I guess it was in the Village Voice and their Indian leader, Swamiji. So he told me one day he was walking down the streets in New York and he heard this sound, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. And people banging on some instruments. And around the corner came this group of people in different bed sheets and things, and he thought, oh, it's the Hare Krishna, you know. And there was this old Indian fellow walking in front of them. He said, oh, it must be their Swami, you know. So he said he came up and then he said Prabhupada looked at him and he kind of nodded. And Prabhupada kind of nodded and he went on. He said that bija, that exchange of glances, was something which would be like a guide in his life, you know, for the next, whatever, 40 years. It kept, always was there, you know. So he said when Prabhupada looked at him, He could appreciate that Prabhupada didn't want anything from him, that Prabhupada was a very competent, intelligent person, knew what he was doing. So he just relaxed and opened his intelligence, his heart. And then Prabhupada kind of nodded at him, which meant, you're not happy. You should join us. And then from the depth of his consciousness, he responded by nodding his head. Well, it's a fact, but I still have a few more options. Like that. And so then Prabhupada nodded from his side, which meant, okay, but if they don't work out, we're here. And so it was an exchange just of a couple nods like that, and really kind of a classical example of the Bhakti Lata Bija. And he wasn't offensive about it. He kept, like, you know, through different years and different experiences, you know, associating with the devotees and hearing a little more, understanding, you know, watering it, until finally he became a temple devotee, everything else like that. So maybe we may get more than one seed. We may get many seeds, many times. But the point I'm trying to make here is it seems that from the very beginning then, we're engaged in bhakti yoga. Because we know what the goal is. We have a little taste of it, you know. But okay, I got my all-expense, paid free vacation in Hawaii for 1 week in December or whatever. Now I have to go back to Chicago, you know. But hey, forget Chicago. I want to live in Hawaii. You know? But yeah, I've got to get a job. I've got to do so many things. I've got to get approval from my family members. So in the beginning, even though we know what the goal is, we have to take care of the work, the activities. We've got to stop smoking. We've got to start getting up in the morning. So we've got to do. So in the beginning, we're engaged in, to some degree, karma, mishra, bhakti yoga. Our bhakti yoga is mixed with karma and activities. But if you do these things prescribed by the acharyas, you know, then we start to begin to ask these questions. What we're doing right now, I guess, would be jnana, mishra bhakti yoga. We start to try and get some logical understanding. You know, what is the most important thing? How do you chant? You chant on beads. Well, you know, do I become a guru? Not. So we start to develop our whole, you know, logical structure. And of course, a logical understanding is the first level of meditation, you know, contemplation. But then it starts to kind of to deepen. And it's shravana disha, and so many different levels are described of actually, you know, meditation like that. So we're still not serving Krishna directly, but we're fixing our mind on him now intensely, more than just a Euclidean logic of if A equals B and B equals C, then C equals D, you know, that kind of stuff. Oh yes, if, you know, reading Srimad Bhagavatam is the same as chanting Hare Krishna. Chanting Hare Krishna is a Yuga Dharma, so reading Srimad Bhagavatam is also Yuga Dharma. Okay, you know. No, but then we start to go on where we actually can, you know, can sit on the chariot and actually shoot arrows while Krishna is saying left, right, jump. So now we're in with Dhyan. And we're trying to come to really becoming pure devotees of Krishna. But in the meditation level, chanting with concentration, now we really know Krishna. And we can really be stimulated, you know, to love him like that. So that's kind of, like our perspective on the different levels of or combinations. We know it's bhakti yoga because we got some experience, but we get attached to different levels. And the thing is not to get attached, because of course it becomes so much gratification to know the philosophy. Prabhu, I know the philosophy. I would explain it to you. Yeah. Or else even you know, meditating on Krishna, you know, without fully surrendering, of course it's a very intense level. Let's go to slide number 9. Okay, and here I have the, to get this one, when I looked on the internet for bell curve. Okay. strange being. You mean, Radhika Raman actually has a bachelor's degree in mathematics. I'm sure you can tell us all about the bell curve. But in any case, the reason I put this up there is because sometimes you might think that the different levels, which could also be described as adoshrada, the sadhu sangha, bhajana kriya, anartha nivritti, nishta, ruchi, asakti, bhava prema. Those are described. Actually, it's interesting. Those are from the Nectar of Devotion. They're paraphrased in the Nectar of Instruction, and they're cited in verse 4:10 of the Bhagavad Gita. And I don't know if they're in the Upanishad or not, but it occurs in every single one of the Bhakti Shastri books, you know. In one form or another, except maybe Isha Upanishad. And sometimes it's paraphrased like that, so you won't find it if you do a database search. You know? But it seems like an extremely important, you know, verse in terms of our spiritual development. In the beginning, we have some preliminary faith that Krishna consciousness might be nice. We've got an invitation to go to some program, and we think, okay, I'll go. I've heard something good about them. But if it's not nice, I won't go again. Okay, we go when it is nice. Then we want to hang out with these people, especially with the Acharya, Prabhupada, Adoshvada, Sadhu Sangha. Then we're starting to chant and do what they do. But then we start asking questions about how to make it scientific. Adoshvada, Sadhu Sangha, Bhajana Kriya. So then we formally matriculate with regular devotees. We're chanting on our beads. And then different things happen. We become fixed. Our bad habits start to go away. We start to get a real taste of serving Krishna, transcendental taste. We can cultivate a particular rasa or combinations. And then we actually we're with Krishna. We're just not quite fully awake. Our love is, we can see who we are, everything else, we're in bhava bhakti. And all we have to do is just, you know, go through that to be fully awake and be prema bhaktas again. So sometimes you might think, but it's like little boxes. You are in Nishta or Ruchi or Asaktis or Baba or Prema, in our German point of view, you know. But my comprehension was, and I heard, I think it was Gorgo Vindemar say the same thing. But yeah, we're kind of like, more like a curve, like you see in this bell curve. Maybe this guy is in, we say the zero here, 34.13. The zero is going to be normal, so he'll be initiated devotee, Bhajana Kriya, and his bad habits are pretty much gone, Narthanavritti. And he's starting to get fixed in his service every morning, Mangalarti, doing his service in the Sankirtan movement, Nishta, and starting to get a little bit of a taste. Okay, so we say basically he's in Nishta. But on the left-hand side, sometimes there's some just doubts, basic doubts about Krishna consciousness, but not very much, 2.5%. On the right side, sometimes there's a real intense experience of you go to Radhakund, and for one moment you have a little spark of water hits you from the gopis playing in Radhakund, and you have an unbelievable experience. Okay, that's 2.5% of the time also, you know. And so, like that, it's where it is. We're all kind of mixed up with different kinds of devotional aspects on different levels, and trying to push the curve more to the right. And of course, Krishna and the gopis are pushing the curve even more to the right, also, with a big competitive atmosphere like that, and so on. So, the best thing is to really figure out what level you're on, and act according to that level, to keep improving your service. And that's the highest reality. And we only want to know these other analytical levels to some degree just to get some perspective on our service, see how we fit in. Okay, next slide here. Okay. So kind of stepping back on number 10 here, just to give a little perspective, because I thought it'll go pretty quick, which it has. Of course, the first two cantos, the first canto, we find a preface. What's the purpose of the book? Who's talking to who? Under what circumstances? The second canto, Sukadeva Goswami begins actually preaching and describes everything very nicely. And then the third canto, where we are now, verses, chapters 1 through 4, basically are this interaction with Vidura, with Uddhava, you know, setting the whole background of his approach to Maitreya. Then the fifth chapter, Vidura starts talking to Maitreya. This dialogue goes on all the way to the fourth canto, 31st chapter, the very, very last chapter in the, fourth canto, like that, last verse. Well, not my last verse. And that's the story of, it's not Myers or Hubina. The Paranjana, Prachetas, the Paranjana, like that. Yeah. And then it says that Vidura was satisfied with his questions from Maitreya. So he glorified him and acknowledged he'd gone. And he left to go back to Hastinapur to try and enliven his family members. So his conversation between Vidura and Maitreya will go all the way through the third canto and all the way through the fourth canto. And actually it's being described, Sudha Goswami is describing what he heard from Sukadeva Goswami. So he's describing what he also heard from Sukadeva Goswami about this conversation. So that's going to be the one starting here in the fifth verse, Vidura and Maitreya. And 13 through 19, they'll talk about the creation, because he should have just asked about Krishna's position in Dwarka, because that was a special knowledge that Krishna gave Uddhava, what his position was there. It was more than what Brahma had learned about Mahavishnu. So he should have asked about that, but because of humility, and other people were present, he asked about these basic principles. So it's very nice. So Maitreya will describe the creation by Mahavishnu, which might be a little tedious because it's very technical. And in the creation of the elements and everything else, then Brahma is created. Then Brahma starts to, the secondary creation, the Sarga, Visarga, starts to manipulate everything. This is how we all got here. And he starts to create different people. The Kumaras, Shiva, Atri, so many people like that. But it's going a little slow, you know, by his mental children. So then he starts to try and engage in biological reproduction with Manu and his good wife. But they can't do that because they have to get down on a much lower level of consciousness. You have to go down to the earth level of consciousness, and the earth has been submerged. So then Varaha comes and kills Hiranyaksha. Well, how did that happen? Where did he come from? That's the story of the pregnancy of Diti in the evening. And that's the story behind that is the story of Jai and Vijay. So it's parenthetical regression within regression. And then, after that's done, then we continue on, you know, with the different children of Manu, like that. And, okay, yeah, they're going to have children now. Things have been straightened out. So after that, we'll see again the children of Manu, Devahuti, Akuti, Prasuti, Uttanapada, Pritivatan, one after another. They'll occur through the third, fourth, fifth, sixth cantos, seventh canto. And that's how the whole Bhagavatam is structured. So first is Devahuti and her son, Kapila, who is the great-grandson of Brahma. So this canto is pretty concentrated in terms of analytical knowledge of this material world and how it actually works. And, of course, this is not impractical. This is where we get Gandharva Veda, Vastu Veda, we call it Ayurveda. These are all based upon this same cosmology of how the world is working. And as we live in that and work in that, then, of course, just naturally we pick up Vastu and all these things very naturally. Or if you want to go into details, you can pick them up in more detail by formally studying them then. And then creating a nice atmosphere, you know, for Krishna consciousness. Okay, what else do I have here? Okay, then I had a final a picture again, slide number 11. We already talked about it. It must be maybe some of our devotees or our members of our audience or our devotees. I remember one time it was like it was Nara Narayan was talking to somebody about how the pictures were actually produced. And he was saying that, of course, so many artists want to do the whole picture and it's very gratifying, you know, for your ego, I painted this picture. But so what it came down to is that some devotees were much better at tapestry and cloth. Others were better at landscape scenes. Others were better portrait artists. Others were better at composition. You know, so they started making teams and accepted a few very good artists, I guess like Parikshit and others. They divided it up. And somebody would talk about it and then somebody would do the composition. Like you see, for example, the composition here, there's the rivers coming through and creating a nice kind of hole in the picture. The trees are creating a circle around the scene. And so Krishna is very much highlighted. There's even a light coming down on him. So that's all the composition like that. Yeah. This is bhakti yoga. And then somebody else, because cloth is very hard to do, to make cloth look realistic. So somebody else would do the cloth and then the flowers and stuff like that. And faces, of course, too, and hands. Yeah. So very, very wonderful to try and create a window on the spiritual world and the scene. And, of course, it says that Krishna was quite comfortable. He had nothing. He was sitting under a tree. He looked, you know, quite peaceful like that. Yeah. I guess he has a club there, you know. And so then he's going to get shot in the foot and die from being shot in the foot. Of course, no one dies from being shot in the foot, but that's his pastime with that. Okay, next picture, number 12. And this is all we could find. We did a search on Uddhava and Krishna. We got back some nice pictures. And this is more like what I think the scene was, that Krishna actually was already preaching to Uddhava, and then Maitreya came. Like that, you know, and then Krishna welcomed him, like that. So one question is, when does the Uddhava Gita occur? Is the Uddhava Gita in the 11th canto, 12th canto? Is that actually the instructions? Because here, of course, is just one or two verses that Uddhava summarizes like that. You know? So I guess that's pretty much it. So if any questions, comments, complaints, if anybody's still, I hope you're still there. Yeah. Are you there?
Okay, Maharaj, give me.
Oh my God, you're still there. Thank you.
Set this up. Can I say something real quick? I was going to say that the bell curve example was very, very good as far as how bhakti develops more than a box. A bell curve is a much better way to state it.
And some. That's the whole thing too. Because why did they pick this bell curve? I mean, it might be something else, some other kind of curve. And the bell curve has a certain mathematic, you know, basis to it and stuff. Okay, maybe that's even books on geometry and nature, you know, and stuff, and how that's actually amazing. There's so many forms and species, they do match up to mathematical symmetries and simple mathematical equations. That's one thing that Newton was interested in all this, because he wanted to see how God was manifest in nature and stuff like that. And his conclusion was, you can't have these kind of mathematical symmetries and stuff unless somebody is there, you know, using them. And then he went back to theology. He only did his science work, I think, from 18 to 21 years old. And everything else before that and after that was on scriptural basis and stuff. He produced like 100,000 word pages or something, 100,000 words, I guess 100,000 words of theology and stuff, which is still, I guess, I think, as I've heard now, maybe Radhika knows, it was in some Russian, Israel had it. And now it's being released, and I think so they're going to start translating it.
Maharish, Sunil Prabhu has some questions about this.
I also have questions, but I'll wait.
Yes, Maharaj, is Vastu Veda part of transcendental knowledge? And secondly, can Vastu Veda be used in Bhakti Yoga?
Okay, let me turn my volume up again here. So is Vastu Veda part of transcendental knowledge, and what's the other thing?
And can Vastu Veda be used in Bhakti Yoga or devotional practice?
Yeah. I mean, it's all Veda. What we're doing, as far as my comprehension, and I ran this by Jayavarta Swami, who's very strict, and he said, yes. What we're doing is Gandharva Veda. Gandharva Veda is singing, and of course the natural result of that is dancing, and that of course all goes into a drama, you know, so singing, dancing, and drama, and that's what we're doing. The whole Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which is our basis of all of our activities, comes out of drama theory, you know, strictly, and so on. And by that process, yeah, you can realize, you know, ultimate knowledge, Veda. So, Vastu Veda, in the Bhagavatam, there are some sections, I mean, even describing some of the principles like that and so on. But that's the whole purpose. I did some research, like for preaching purposes one time, and looking back at historically, I guess like they go back, like Prabhupada says, basically like 500 BC, and that's about all they say at that point. We're speculating. Even they mentioned that. But before that, and putting things together, apparently there was Pancha Siddhantika, five different sources of Vastu, and one of them was Maya Dhanava Prakash, and the other one was Maya Dhanava Dhanvantari, the other guy. He's the demigod. Anyway, I'll come back. The demigod, the architect for the demigods. Anyway, okay. Vishvakarma. Yeah, Vishvakarma. Samhita or something. So the Maya Dhanava Samhita, whatever it was architecture for enhancing sense gratification. So probably his things would tell you how to make casinos in Las Vegas, that kind of stuff, which would stimulate your lusty desires and stimulate different lower modes. But then the other one by Vishvakarma was actually stimulating renunciation, higher perspectives. And of course there are instructions where the deity should be situated, you know, and how he should be facing and things like that. So yeah, I would say all these things can be used very, very effectively. And actually we should use them. And I would say intuitively we do use them intuitively and stuff and so on. But yeah, we can also learn them and apply them.
Jai Maharaj, thanks.
Okay.
I had a question about Maitreya Muni. This is also mentioned by Prabhupada Bhattadamadara Goswami when he gave his class on Tuesday. The verse 9 describes Maitreya as a Mahabhagavata, a great devotee. But then he's described that he has like impersonal tendencies. You know, it seems like, how could he be a Mahabhagavata and still have impersonal tendencies?
That's a really good question. I don't know. Yeah. I do that. For example, Shukracharya probably says he's a spiritual master of the demons. He said spiritual master. So it seems probably is including spiritual master to include somebody who knows Brahman, who has Brahman realized. You know? But what your point you're making is he's called a Bhagavata. I don't know the exact verse and stuff. Mahabhagavata. Maybe it's describing him after.
Nine.
Yeah, maybe it describes him after he became self-realized or something like that. You know, I don't know. And you pop up here, database offline. I go to Srimad Bhagavatam, click. I go to Canto 3, click. I go to verse 4, click. And I go to number 9, and it says, at that time, after traveling in many parts of the world, Maitreya, a great devotee of the Lord, and a friend and well-wisher of the great sage Krishna Dwaipayana, reached the spot of his own perfect accord. Tasmin Mahabhagavato. Okay. Yeah. So maybe, you know, great devotee of the Lord, but you also say Garuda Bhagavan. Yeah. So greatly possessed of great opulences in that respect. Yeah. But other than that, I don't know. I can't apply, you know, I understand why. There's one point I seem to have read, like some other description of this pastime, like in a lecture or something like that, because there are different things that I remember, you know, probably said about it, but I can't find it exactly in this description here, like that. You know, so probably making more comments about this.
Well, the other thing about this, although I asked the same question on Tuesday of Maharaj, but and then I'm still confused of why would Uddhava be taking instruction from Maitreya if Uddhava is on a more exalted platform?
No, Vidura is taking instructions from Maitreya.
I'm sorry. Missed it up. Oh, excuse me.
Yeah. Because it's just like, why are the gopis taking instructions from Uddhava?
Yeah.
Uddhava's not even qualified to. Uddhava's hoping he can hang out in Vrindavan as a blade of grass. He's not pushing to be a coconut tree or a banana tree. You know, it's not to get carried away here. You know, what is speaking of a cowherd boy, and the gopis are taking instructions from Uddhava. You know, because they're mailmen. You know, that's one thing. Oh. You can't give somebody you don't have. You have to accept somebody. He's a Mahabhagavata's guru. Papa's not here. Take shelter of this person, that person. No, yeah, you can. A mailman can bring you something, you know. And then if you take care of it properly. So Maitreya heard, and this is what I understand. I can't find it. Is that there were two reasons why Uddhava sent Vidura to talk to Maitreya. The first one was he didn't want to engage in Guru Maryada Vyatikrama. Vidura was already like his father, and Maitreya was like his grandfather. So for him to start showing off his knowledge in front of Maitreya would have been like very, you know, distasteful.
I see.
And much better. You know? And the second thing was that he knew that Maitreya had heard everything, but he hadn't realized it.
Mm-hmm.
And so by sending Vidura, and actually if you watch the dialogue, you'll see that Vidura suggests to Maitreya, now you should, my dear Guru Dev, maybe you can talk about this, maybe you can talk about that, maybe you can talk about this. So Vidura, like you say, has more comprehension. And when Vidura asks, and Maitreya smiles and nods, yes, yeah, very good, exactly. You know? And so they're taking these other positions, but in some ways Vidura, yeah, is more advanced, and he's teaching Maitreya by being the student.
I see. Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hare Krishna.
Oh, yes.
Hare Bol Maharaj, this is Mahesh.
Hare Bol.
Haribol, just coming back to the previous question concerning the Mayavadi conception versus the Bhagavad conception. In the book Journey Home by Radhanath Swami, he explains he talks about one time when Srila Prabhupada was asked that question and how Prabhupada answered the question, the Mayavad or impersonal conception versus the personal. And Prabhupada said very simply that, I'm quoting here from the book, we must first understand the inconceivable nature of God. The Supreme Lord is simultaneously personal and impersonal. It is an eternal truth that he is both formless and that he has an eternal blissful form. So he's both things at the same time. So I can only assume that some of the Mayavadi Mayavadi devotees, basically they have that conception of the impersonal form, but they didn't reach the Bhagavad conception of God. So there could be great devotees that are Mayavadis, it's just they didn't reach the other conception. And I think the main reason would be because they didn't really came in contact with a devotee that would give them the realization. I mean, you just don't give that realization, you know, out of nowhere.
Yeah, of course, everybody's popping up and down now because the two examples are the Kumaras and Sukadeva Goswami. Yeah? And Sukadeva Goswami was an impersonalist. The devotees didn't like his company so much. And then the Kumaras, they also, too, they were impersonalists, but they weren't, kind of this distinction comes up of Mayavadi and Brahmavadi. The Mayavadis in general have this aggressive thing of saying there is no God, and they know there is a God, they don't like it. And the Brahmavadis are people that can say this, haven't come in contact. So how did the Kumaras get the personal conception? You know how they got it?
Well, the four Kumaras, no, I don't know exactly the story of how they became impersonal, but
they went to see Vishnu, and they were good boys. They paid their obeisances. When they paid their obeisances, they smelled the aroma of the tulsi leaves, Makaranda Vayu, at his lotus feet, and they knew we're detached. You know, we're detached from all material variety, but this is not material variety. And so at that point, they became devotees. And they realized the personal form of the Lord was transcendental.
Yeah, that's why prasadam is so important. Because when you taste prasadam, you know, hey, this food is not the same as that food. Why?
Yeah. You just can't stop eating sometimes. I remember one guy, we had a program in San Francisco. It was right after Prabhupada's lecture. They had a lunch for the press people that came. And one guy was this really big, robust guy. And he started eating prasadam. And he was eating, and he said, my God, this food is good. It was amazing. My God, this food is good. I have something for you, Mahesh.
Go ahead.
That's my Peruvian cana.
Oh, wow.
Come to Peru.
Very nice. I have a cana myself here. I got it when I was in Bolivia.
Oh, it's actually mine's from Bolivia also. Yeah, it's better than Peru. Actually, the name for Bolivia is Alto Peru, and Peru is called Bajo Peru. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Any other comments here about, it's a very, very nice scene, very ecstatic scene. You know, with Krishna and Uddhava and Maitreya Muni. Wow. Better than LSD or something else. It must have been a really intoxicating scene to be there with those people like that. And, of course, it's the third canto. You know, by the tenth canto, of course, we're going to maybe be able to understand. Prabhupada says if you can understand the love of the gopis for Krishna after 1 million lifetimes, you're making rapid progress. So here we are in the third canto trying to understand, you know, Uddhava and Maitreya and their love for Krishna. Okay, so I guess we'll go ahead here with our devotional service. It's 12 o'clock here now, so we'll go ahead and cook a little bit of lunch for Lord Nrsimhadev. He's been our deity, I don't know, maybe like 35 years now. He's been with us, and we've been with him, and he's really helped us through a lot of situations like that. So he likes to eat. I noticed that. So we're going to try and make some khichdi for him today.
And well, tomorrow we thank you, Maharaj.
Tomorrow's Panihati Festival in Atlanta. It's always a real...
Oh, is it?
Under the trees, yeah. Like that. Very nice. Okay, so thank you all very, very much. Hare Krishna.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna. Jai Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
Thank you.